Hey, welcome back from your time off. It's the Takeaway Podcast for May 31st, 2016. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The battle for Fallujah has become the battle for Iraq and the most important test of the Iraqi military since the U.S. invasion. Local ground forces backed by U.S.-led military aircraft launched an operation on Monday to storm the ISIS stronghold of Fallujah. This morning, ISIS militants launched a counterattack as Iraqi government troops pushed into the city. 50,000 Iraqis are believed to be trapped inside that city. And Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, helping displaced families, said this about the situation. A human catastrophe is unfolding in Fallujah. Families are caught in the crossfire with no way out. Fallujah has been taken and retaken since 2003, and expelling ISIS will involve a sustained effort if the Iraqis are to move on to the even bigger prize of oil-rich, ISIS-controlled, and water-rich Mosul. A dam in Mosul controls water flow for hundreds of miles. Mike Pregent is an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. Army intelligence officer in Iraq. He served as an intelligence advisor to General David Petraeus.
We haven't talked about Fallujah for 2 years. Fallujah has been under siege. It's been shelled and starved by Shia militias for 2 years, and there hasn't been one effort by the U.S. military or the Iraqi government to actually recruit Sunnis from Fallujah and from Al-Anbar to retake territory that ISIS holds that close to Baghdad. Fallujah only became necessary after ISIS demonstrated its reach to target Shia areas in Baghdad and Sadr City. Shia population centers demanded protection and also demanded retribution, and Fallujah is right there. It's the perfect target to punish a Sunni population for what ISIS has done. And if you look at the populations, 50,000 Sunnis and 600 to 1,000 ISIS fighters. You don't punish a Sunni city of 50,000 to rid it of 600 to 1,000 ISIS fighters. What you do is you build trust with that Sunni community, that population. You have them become intelligence assets. You bring them into the Iraqi armed services. They become your eyes and ears on the ground, and they are the ones that will call in airstrikes, not Shia militias, and that's what's happening.
So you believe this has nothing to do with ISIS. It's a sectarian battle approved by Muqtada al-Sadr and being carried out by the Iraqi military.
Well, I mean, if you look at the Sadr protests, I'm glad you brought up Sadr. You look at Sadr protests a couple weeks ago, it had nothing to do with defeating ISIS. He was basically vying for influence and a paycheck. He didn't say that the government needs to do outreach to Sunni population centers. He didn't say that the government needed to curb Iranian influence. He didn't even bring up ISIS. This was about Shia militias and Sadr and the Iraqi government believing that they had done enough to protect Shia areas from ISIS. There was no intent to go into Mosul anytime soon. Fallujah became the thing you could take off the shelf and all of a sudden focus everybody on this battle for Fallujah to rid it of ISIS when it's been there for 2 years. Fallujah was the first city to fall to ISIS in January 2014. To say all of a sudden that this became the number one priority for the Iraqi government and the U.S. military effort after all the hype on Mosul the last 6 months. But it's a farce, in my opinion. And if I was on the ground, if this was 2007, I would not be alone in demanding or pounding the desk and saying, sir, we cannot be part of any operation that where it looks like we're providing close air support to Shia militias. This is not how you win over Sunnis. This is not how you defeat a counterinsurgency. And this is not how you defeat ISIS. We're simply resetting the conditions to January 2014. ISIS thrives in Sunni population centers where they feel oppressed by their government. This operation in Ramadi, this operation in Fallujah are examples of that, where their government is punishing a Sunni population center.
But tactically, is there any way to evaluate whether this city will be retaken, or do you think it is a siege to punish the Sunnis and actually has no tactical value at all?
Well, it's going to be called a victory, but so was Ramadi. If you look at Ramadi, 80% of that town is destroyed. It's uninhabitable. People can't return to open their stores and move back into their homes. It was destroyed to rid it of 300 to 600 ISIS fighters. So if you look at what's going on, I count 15 Iranian-backed Shia militias that are in the operation. No one's denying that now. The Institute for the Study of War has a graphic that shows Shia militias on the ground. There are other graphics that show Shia militias on the ground. They're within artillery range. They're within sniper range. This is a Shia militia operation, and we're relying on Iraqi government spokespeople people to tell us what's going on. Every Western media report is preceded by an Iraqi government official says this is happening. We have no idea what's going on in Fallujah because we don't have anybody on the ground doing this. And unfortunately, we don't have Western media on the ground reporting this. If you look at Russia today, they are right there with Shia militias as they move into Fallujah. They are touting the role that the Shia militias are playing. And they get to point in the skies and show American aircraft conducting bombing runs in support of these operations. There's no way to win back Sunnis. So I think it's a failed ISIS strategy, and I would recommend that U.S. halts close air support until the Shia militias are addressed. Not that they go away, that they are addressed, that they are told they are not legitimate forces on the battlefield.
How do you tell that from the flags?
You can't. I went to Iraq
right,
recently.
Exactly.
I went to Iraq recently and met with a Peshmerga general that I worked with in Mosul. And he said, you know what? We can defeat ISIS. That's not a problem. But the problem is the Shia militias carry Iraqi flags. And when they encroach and we respond, we look like traitors because we're firing upon units that would be carrying the Iraqi flag. So, yeah, exactly.
Mike Pregen is an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. Army intelligence officer in Iraq who served as an intelligence advisor to General David Petraeus. Up the road from Fallujah and still west of Baghdad, the city of Ramadi has also been traded back and forth between the opposition and government forces in Iraq. Retired Colonel Tony Dean, a 28-year veteran of the Army, was on the ground during the 2006 Battle of Ramadi. His new book is called Ramadi Declassified, A Roadmap to Peace in the Most Dangerous City in Iraq. He talks about how he and his men were able to work with the local population to take back the city from al-Qaeda and how that could help win the war against ISIS today.
Anytime that you're taking land back from a terrorist group like ISIS, it's a good thing. And the Sunni people have been the biggest victims of the terrorists, be it al-Qaeda in Iraq or their current incarnation of ISIS. That said, are they taking back Fallujah because they want to get rid of the terrorists, or is this some more Shia-Sunni violence play into an internal audience and they're really just, you know, launching off on the Shia one more time? And so it's really hard to see inside of Iraqi politics, and there's a lot of turmoil going on over there with Mitad al-Sadr and the rest of the Sadrists raising up. So, you know, I wonder if this is really the next strategic move, or was this to placate the Shias?
Which leads to a much bigger question, and that is, what was the opportunity in Iraq? President George W. Bush had this idea that there was some weapons of mass destruction issue. We go into Iraq. Chaos erupts by the time you get there in 2006. There were some significant victories, but yet, even though, you know, we don't speak of exit strategies, Barack Obama says we're out of Iraq, there is this sense of a mission having utterly lost its way in Iraq. If you were a, you know, five-star or four-star commanding CENTCOM, what would you prescribe for Iraq and the Middle East generally right now?
I think one of the biggest issues that we have is if you look at what's the alternative. So if you're a Sunni, if you're a Sunni man, what are your options? I can throw in with the terrorist, or I can throw in with the government in Baghdad that has proven it's out to get me. So until there's some sort of political accommodation in Iraq that has some power-sharing government, we'll just keep doing what we're doing. And if you think about it, people talk about an open-ended commitment. We've been bombing Iraq my entire adult life. I have been in Iraq since I've been a kid, you know, since I first came in the Army. And so for 25 years, we've been going at it, trying to do it on the cheap. And I'd say, you know, it's going to take a long-term commitment. And if how we get, you know, ISIS will fall. Sooner or later, they'll fall. But another group will come in their place if we don't have the institutions in place to help the Iraqis and help the people across the Middle East, you know, take care of their own problems.
And so your models are Germany at the end of World War II, Japan at the end of World War II, the long-term commitment in Korea, not Desert Storm.
No, I mean, I was a veteran in Desert Storm, and that's good. Those things are needed, but
you describe Desert Storm as a huge unlucky break for the United States when you really think of what it meant.
I think it gave people a big false expectation of what the military can and cannot do.
And that's hard to say because that's your big victory. That's your first,
yeah,
as a kid, big victory.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
wish we'd lost.
Well,
I know you don't say that. I know you're not saying that. But
I think that we really temper. I think people said, oh, the military can do anything in 100 hours. And it really is long-term commitment. And the other thing, if you look at long-term commitment, if you look at Italy, post-war Italy had, what, 43, right. 45 governments?
Exactly.
And it took the American presence, not a large one, but there was an American presence there that was kind of that steady hand that got them through those years. And, you know, to think, you know, there were a tremendous amount of missteps. And you can debate going into the war. There was a lot of reasons why, and there wasn't on both sides. But the debaffification policies, you know,
it was disaster.
A disaster. Yeah. Disbanding the army, disaster. Throwing in with these external people like Shalaby, disaster. But by 2006, things had gotten pretty good. Well, by 2006, the tide had turned. General Petraeus came in with the surge. 7 and 8, things got pretty good. And really, towards the end there, things were running pretty well. And actually, Maliki went after the Shia death squads down in Basra at the end of 10. And so things looked like they were going the right way. But when we left, we were the honest broker. When we, you know, by 2010, the Americans were seen as the honest broker. And when we left, Maliki arrested the vice president, Tashimi. He had to leave the country, and he purged the army of capable Sunnis, and he sent the army into Anbar.
Do you think the American people are prepared to make a decision one way or another to go either towards the patient approach that you're talking about or just throwing up their hands?
I don't think throwing up their hands are an option. I mean, it is if you want to have attacks on American soil. I mean, you know, rather fight them there than fight them here, okay? We've really politicized, especially Iraq, and to a lesser extent Afghanistan. If you think back after September 11th, the unity that was in this country, you flash forward 4 years later and the country's ready to come apart at the seams. And so all politicians need to say, hey, I can't solve this problem in my term, be it a, you know, a representative or a president or my 2 terms or whatever. This is going to take some thought and some long term because we've been trying to do it on the cheap for the past 25 years.
Colonel Tony Dean, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Retired Colonel Tony Dean is a 28-year veteran of the Army and was on the ground during the 2006 Battle of Ramadi. His new book is called Ramadi Declassified, A Roadmap to Peace in the Most Dangerous City in Iraq. Is it safe if you're black to call 911 today in Ferguson, Missouri?
To believe that Delrish Moss comes here with a magic answer for all of Ferguson's problems is a unique or actually a naive view. I think that the answers lie in Ferguson.
And Ferguson is where the brand new police chief, Delrish Moss, will have to find those answers. Moss comes from Miami, Florida, where he was head of communications for the Miami PD. He will have some communicating to do as he tries to fix what the Justice Department found in Ferguson, a culture of intolerance, prejudice, and exploitation from unnecessarily loosing dogs on suspects, to generating income from arrests rather than protecting public safety, to arresting concerned loved ones at the scene of an accident. Black residents feared to call the police, the report found, because it often caused more problems than it solved. Delrish Moss is the new head of the Ferguson Police Department and told Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick that while Ferguson is nationally symbolic of the issue of police misconduct, the solutions are all in the local community.
The Ferguson that I've seen, and I can't really speak to what the DOJ saw when they got here, because that's not what I've seen. I mean, I've seen a police department that's struggling to move forward into the future. I've seen some good police officers who really want to get past what has happened in the past. And so far, everyone's been welcoming and willing to work with me and work with the changes that we need to make.
Now, it occurs to me that you consumed this news initially along with the rest of us in the rest of the country. You were working down in Miami, of course, for the police department there. But do you remember what you thought as you saw the riots in Ferguson and the killing of Michael Brown unfold?
Well, the first thing I thought was I remembered Miami some 30 years ago when we had riots and we had racial strife and a number of problems in the city. I also realized that somewhere in all of that is a truer story of a community that has its issues, that has its struggles, and it's going to work to try to get past those. Now, you know, I wasn't so naive to think that there weren't problems in the city and that the problems had to have occurred long before the killing of Michael Brown for it to erupt the way that it did. But I did realize that in all of that strife, in all of those things, that there was a kernel of hope that was going to come from, you know, the upheaval.
All right, so now you're there and you're on the job. What's job one? Let's talk about job one, two, and three. But as you read the DOJ report and as you've talked to people around Ferguson, officers, city leaders, citizens, I'm sure, what does your list look like right now?
Well, my list has really been about assessment. I've been doing a top-to-bottom assessment of the department. I've been doing a get-out-and-meet members of the community, and I'm actually hearing what people have to say. Because, of course, in media reports, you get snippets, but it's on the ground that you actually get a truer picture of what happened, what needs to happen, and the prescription for going forward. Of course, I've been reading the DOJ report, and there's certain mandates in that that have to be met. But there are other things, other issues that I'm going to discover as I talk to people, police officers, and city leaders. What I've gotten from most of them is they all want the same things. They want a better community. They want actually to get out from under the national gaze or the national spotlight. But that's a long way from happening.
Has this been a lot of community meetings or dinners or people coming into your office? What has it been like?
I've been walking up and down the street, talking to people, talking to residents. But I've also been in restaurants. I've been in businesses. I've gone a number of places, community groups. You name it, I've been there. You know, I want to get a wide cross-section of Ferguson and what Ferguson suggests. I think that, you know, to believe that Delrish Moss comes here with a magic answer for all of Ferguson's problems is a unique or actually a naive view. I think that the answers lie in Ferguson. It just takes that unique perspective to help them get to that point.
How far does just straight up diversity go here? More black officers, more women officers, more Latino officers? I don't know. How far does just that go?
Well, diversity is certainly key to the success of any organization in that you have multiple voices at the table providing differing points of view. Because one of the things I've noticed here is that everyone in Ferguson wants a better community. They want a crime-free community. They want a community where they can raise their children. But there are a multitude of views as to how they get there. And so you need all those voices at the table in the police department and without in order to arrive at a better solution.
Now, of course, you're an outsider. There's no surprise there. You're from Miami. They have a saying in situations like this sometimes that nobody wants somebody who nobody sent. And you're from somewhere else. Is that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem. I mean, you know, I'd be naive to think that everyone is going to welcome me with open arms. I'd be naive to think that everyone thinks that I am the person to solve this situation. But I think that when we all put our heads together, when we all want to get to a certain place, I think at some point through time, persistence, and hard work, we'll get there.
So you're the police chief, and of course you're responsible for the police. But, you know, as you go around and talk to community activists in your town and just regular residents, do you have a sense from them what trust looks like in the future, what it actually means from the eyes of city resident, even an African-American city resident in Ferguson, to say, yeah, this police force is here to protect me? What does that look like?
Well, trust is something that needs to be built. It's a long road from me starting to where we get to the point of trust. I mean, there are a number of things that also add to that. We look at African-Americans and the perception of how we view policing. Well, there's a long, rich history of racial strife, disparate treatment, and a number of things that speak to this Ferguson situation. So some people are looking at Ferguson because they were sitting in their living room saying, you know what, that happened to me 20 years ago. That happened to me 30 years ago. I myself became a police officer because I had two negative encounters with police officers. In one case, I was actually called a racial slur, and that made me join the police department. So, you know, just like I joined the Miami Police Department because I wanted to provide better services for the community I grew up in, when I saw what was happening in Ferguson, I thought that I had a unique perspective that might be helpful to the situation here. And so I packed up my things and I came out.
A brand new Chief Moss in charge of the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, after years of strife and national scrutiny and federal government reports, civil rights reports on the state of the police department there. Chief Delrish Moss of Ferguson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A
A nice day at the zoo at the beginning of a Memorial Day weekend becomes a moment of terror. A 400-pound gorilla found a 4-year-old boy in the Cincinnati Zoo primate exhibit on Friday. He climbed over a barrier, and when the crowd saw the gorilla dragging the boy, it went wild. Zoo officials got a high-powered rifle, and the gorilla was shot and killed. Video of the death of Harambe, the gorilla, instantly were posted online, and thousands responded to a petition to stop zoos altogether. Thane Maynard is director of the Cincinnati Zoo and had a clear message for those second-guessing the zoo's decision.
I mean, the truth is that Western lowland gorillas, of which Harambe is, you know, are a non-aggressive, quite peaceful species. They're not territorial. The main reason for aggression among those sorts of gorillas is a male competitor coming close to some females. So I agree that I don't think that, you know, anyone expert who has looked at the video has seen overt aggression in the gorilla. I think what the zoo was struggling with was the possibility that the crowds and the situation would agitate the gorilla, and either accidentally or because he got so stressed, the child might have been seriously injured. But, you know, I'd like to know more about the, you know, the history of that particular gorilla. And I wish animal care staff, who would obviously know him best of all, had been more directly involved in making a decision about whether he should be shot or not.
And this does raise the question, as you've raised a moment ago, that, you know, what is the plan B here? I mean, what do they have a clearly worked out plan for something like this, or do they just assume the design will prevent anyone from getting into the caged area or the walled off area? It seems as though they just had no plan.
From the zoo's perspective, that design, the zoo has said, had worked for 38 years. So it's obvious that over time, eventually it didn't work, and they'll obviously revisit it. But I think that the more important point is, no matter what the design, no matter what the plan, when animals are in zoos, bad things can happen. I mean, there was an incident in Argentina just a little while ago where a person entered a lion enclosure and the two lions had to be shot. So when you mix people and animals together in these captive settings, I think it's impossible to prevent any and all types of incidents and problems. And that also, it's important just to say that even when things are going right at zoos, the lives of gorillas, for example, at zoos are not very great lives. I mean, gorillas exhibit many types of stereotypical behaviors which show boredom or stress. They don't like to be looked at, which is obviously why they're there in the zoo. And surveys have indicated that perhaps half of all zoos that keep gorillas give them psychotropic drugs to mood stabilize them. So I think that's really an important message to get out to people, is that the lives in general, regardless of whether there's children accessing an environment, of these animals is a pretty difficult compromised life. And the zoos justify it mainly by saying that they're helping conserve the species. But if you measure their success against the trajectory of all these species that they're allegedly helping promote conservation of, you'd have to say that they're utterly failing in that mission. And so that does really raise a big question about whether zoos can be justified anymore.
You've got two mobs here also. You've got the mob at the zoo freaking out over the kid inside the cage, agitating the gorilla. And presumably the zoo made a decision based, as you're saying, on that crowd. But then you've got another mob on the internet saying, oh, the poor gorilla. I mean, how does that shift so quickly? And are they different people talking?
Well, I think it's very different people talking. I mean, once the child's in the enclosure, you've got a real problem. And probably from the zoo's point of view, you know, I mean, just to be completely blunt about it, the downside of shooting their gorilla, who's one of nine, and that zoo is a very prolific breeder of gorillas, is you have a dead gorilla. The downside of a child being killed is probably, to most of the world, a bigger tragedy and probably a massive lawsuit. And so you can see where the zoo ended up making the decision they made. I do think that if the child had been injured or killed, we'd be having a different conversation. So I do have some sympathy for the quandary the zoo was in. I don't have as much sympathy for just the fact that, you know, the zoos inevitably put people and animals in this sort of position at some point or another.
Is the gorilla an endangered species?
That gorilla is a critically endangered species. And that particular gorilla that they shot is part of a quote-unquote species survival plan, which is mainly a breeding plan to promote and propagate the species. But the reality of zoo breeding programs tends to be that they're breeding gorillas and animals to populate zoos. For example, in the United States, there's never been a single elephant that has ever gone back into the wild. And these gorillas that the Cincinnati Zoo are so good at breeding are going to other zoos. They're not going to the western lowlands of Africa to repopulate the species there. So what they're talking about is basically preserving a species in captivity. And if that's our measure of success, then I'd say we're failing terribly, because the important thing is to try to conserve the environment in which the gorillas exist in Africa. And I just don't think zoos are really conveying the message bluntly enough to their visitors, what visitors need to do and the ways in which they need to think about their lifestyle that affects these gorillas in the wild.
Tim Zimmerman is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What about your last visit to a zoo? What was it like? Should we keep animals in zoos? San Mateo, California. I think zoos can serve an important purpose in the education of visitors about animals and the preservation of many species. I was just talking to my granddaughter, with whom I went to the San Francisco Zoo many times. I think she had the best answer. She texted me, "I think conservation and sanctuaries and endangered species should have a home in zoos, but my friends and I dislike the traditional establishment of them where money and people's entertainment are the priority."
This is Michelle calling from Honolulu. Zoos should only be used if their living spaces can replicate how they live in the wild, and the boundaries have to be idiot-proof. That gorilla died because of human error, period.
This is Mark Mannheimer from Bradford, Massachusetts. Ultimately, I am against zoos, as I feel they are not caring and fair for the animals confined there. One cannot help but think of the messages from the many Planet of the Apes films. How would we feel if the tables were turned? Yes, it's nice to educate our children by allowing them to see these animals live, but they can see them live on video and TV, and maybe there would be more encouragement to travel and actually see these animals in their natural environments.
Describe your zoo visit at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. The Takeaway has decided that we need to step back and really take a lighter look at the election. And Paul Scheer is our guide. His new show, by the way, is called Filthy Preppy Teens. Scheer has been closely following the election regardless of that, and he's got great material.
To me, I find this election to be frightening and the most engaging election ever, because one person figured out, oh, people like reality TV, right?
Yeah.
I'm just going to make that into the presidential race. And I think that's what Trump has kind of done. But this is for not like for a TV show. This is for be the president of the United States.
I don't think Trump did it, though. I think the audience did it.
Yeah. But the thing that's so crazy to me is, like, I love that slam, like, we don't want a career politician in there. It's like saying, like, I don't want a doctor that went to med school. I want a guy that just has a razor and is going to try to get me better. I don't care. It's like you want someone who understands the political process, like a little bit, just a little bit. We are, 10, 15 years away from monster trucks in the White House, I really do feel.
Was the conventions. That's the first thing. And so, you've been to both places, Cleveland and Philly.
Yeah. Yeah, I have.
Give me a plot. Give me a scenario. Pitch me a show.
I feel like, it's going to be – I feel like the Republicans are all going to be putting in their – like, who's their next guy? Like, I feel like they need to – I think that they need to rebrand that party, but I think in a way to be like, okay, I know – we had 18 people and we kind of messed up. This is our new guy and this will be our woman and this will be it. This will be our person. I feel like that's the only way they can save face is like check back with us in about 8 years and we'll have a semblance of something again.
All right, that's good. Just keep going. How about the Democrats?
The Democrats, I feel like, it's sort of to me the Bernie and Hillary thing is a bummer because I like what Bernie represents and everything, but I also feel like it's like when you're watching your favorite NBA team and they're going to like game 7 and you're like, I just need them to wrap up this series early because they need to rest for the next one. Yep. The next one's going to be the one. And I feel like this, just even the continuing of this primary, it's just sort of like, you're not going to get the nomination. So just like, can we bow out gracefully? And just like, Hillary's never had it easy. So she's just going to take, not going to change.
Yeah.
We'll see. I like Elizabeth Warren a lot. I'm curious to see where she goes. I just like that she can go toe-to-toe with Trump without necessarily being as reality show-esque.
Depending on what happens, this could be a huge moment for How Did This Get Made?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. How Did This Get Made? It's a podcast I do where we talk about bad movies. But if you really listen closely, every bad movie is making a comment. It's a metaphor for what's going on in our political system, what's going on in the world. So, you know, you start to tie things together. Recently, we did Hell Comes to Frogtown, which was a rowdy Roddy Piper movie about the last virile man in the world who has to impregnate the last women that are able to have babies.
Yeah, I mean, we will be asking after this election, how did this get made? That
oh,
is a fact.
I mean, it is going to be – I can't imagine where it will go. Primaries are always a little bit messy, but it kind of cleans up by this point, and it hasn't cleaned up yet. Do you still have that crazy?
So have you made your travel plans depending on how the election turns out? You got a passport issue?
Look, I just have to hope that I get booked on a Canadian TV show. No, I want to stay in America. I will stay in America because I feel like we got to support what's going on here. And look, maybe the prices of real estate will go down drastically and you can get a nice big piece of land and maybe move to Montana or something.
Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Actor and comedian Paul Scheer, his new show is Filthy Preppy Teens.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Warriors Stewart by becoming only the 10th team out of 223 to win a best-of-seven series while trailing 3-1.
That's the final call of Game 7 between the Golden State Warriors and the Oklahoma City Thunder last night in Oakland. Steph Curry scored 36 points to beat the Thunder 96-88, thanks to TNT there for that audio.
You can't take anything for granted because it's such a grind. It's such a battle against a great Thunder team that pushed us to the brink. So you got to be appreciative of this accomplishment.
The Warriors get a tiny bit of a break before they take on LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers on Thursday night in a rematch of last year's NBA Finals. Joining me now is Sekou Smith, sports reporter and senior analyst for NBA Digital at Turner Broadcasting. Welcome back, Sekou.
Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm good. Did you think they were out of it? The Warriors were out of it?
Yeah, like a lot of people, when they were down 3-1, I was making plans for Oklahoma City for the finals. But they became one of just 10 teams in the history of the league to rally from a 3-1 deficit to win a series. And they showed the heart of a champion. They really did. They believed in themselves when no one else did. And to watch them win those last three games in that series was remarkable. Just the way they found a way each and every time between Steph Curry, Klay Thompson and the rest of those guys for the Warriors, they refused to go away. And that's why they're playing for a championship again.
When the Thunder went up 3-1, it seemed to me they really were hungry for it, they felt as though this was their last chance. How did the Warriors respond to that?
Well, I think, part of playing under the pressures that come with the NBA playoffs is your true identity is revealed. Whatever type of team you are, whatever your makeup is, if you have the right camaraderie, if your chemistry is what it needs to be, it comes through under those pressure-packed moments. And the Thunder really came apart when it mattered most. They didn't stick together and play the way they needed to in pressure-packed games. On their home floor in Oakland, they simply could not finish the deal. And the Warriors, meanwhile, believing in each other, trusting in each other, and having the muscle memory of winning a championship last year, found ways to win those games. And I think it really came down strictly to who they were as a group. I think the Warriors group was simply stronger and more cohesive than what the Thunder had.
Now, the Warriors will be facing a Cleveland Cavaliers team that's very different from last year. They're healthy, and there are some serious questions about the Warriors because of what the Thunder was able to do. What do you think this series will be like?
Well, I think it's going to be as entertaining and as a roller coaster ride, the same way it was last year when the Warriors beat the Cavaliers in 6 games. I think it's going the full 7 this time. And the Cavaliers are a different team, but they still have some of the same inherent mismatches that don't favor them when playing the Warriors. You know, if they want to get into a three-point shooting contest with the greatest shooting team and the greatest shooting backcourt that we've seen, that's a dangerous proposition. I think having Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving healthy, of course, gives LeBron James two pieces that he didn't have in this series last year, and that could change the tone of it as well. But the Warriors are so confident, and there's such a belief in what they do and how they play and their resolve that they've shown against, you know, all odds throughout these playoffs. Without Steph Curry for six games, you know, unanimous MVP, sits out for six games, and his teammates found ways to win continuously with or without him.
All right, so Psycho Smith, sports reporter and senior analyst for NBA Digital at Turner Broadcasting. We'll see you for the finals.
Thank you, John.
And here's a very little something to take with you today. Memo to NASA, to Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. If you folks have a fueled up rocket, this might be the day for launch. That's right, Mars and Earth haven't been this close in 11 years. Unfortunately, the rest of us will just have to be satisfied watching the red planet through binoculars, which NASA says will be really easy to see if it's not cloudy at about midnight Eastern time every night this week. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway, and you can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet your questions to me at Jay Hockenberry. And subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work, a great way to stay up on the news. Hang out with us at the beach. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.